It was past 8 when I got home, and immediately I felt the stillness. "Gramps?" I called. But just like the night before, he didn't answer. His door was closed. I knocked and waited. Nothing. The car was out front. I took the stairs to the basement in case he was doing laundry, but the machines were silent. In the kitchen, the eggs I'd left him were untouched in their bowl, the tea bag dry in the cup. Ocean Beach. I would look for him there. I grabbed a sweater and went out to the street. The sky was darkening and the headlights on the great highway shone as I darted across. I ran onto the sand and up through the dunes. Beach grass grazed my ankles. A flock of birds flew overhead. And then I was passing the warning sign that everybody ignored, even though the danger it warned of was undeniably true. I thought of Gramps's soaking pants legs, of his skeleton body, of the blood on the handkerchiefs. I had a clear view of the water now, but not enough light to make out details. I wished for my mother's friends, but skilled as they were, even they didn't surf at dusk. There were a few clusters of people out walking, a couple lone figures with dogs. No old men that I could see. I turned back. Inside again, I knocked on his door. Silence. Panic tilted my vision. A succession of flights and drops, the right throbs and the wrong. This was my mind, playing tricks on me. I was being hysterical. Gramps left the house all the time, and I had barely been home all summer, so why would he be here now for me? I stood right on the other side of his door. "Gramps!" I screamed. It was so loud he couldn't have slept through it. And when silence still followed, I told myself that everything was fine. In the kitchen, I put a pot of water on the stove. Before the water reaches a boil, he will be here. I dropped the pasta in and set the timer. Before the 10 minutes are up, I melted some butter. I wasn't hungry, but I would eat it anyway, and by the time I was done, he would walk through the door and call out my name. The clock ticked. I ate as slowly as I could. But then the bowl was empty, and I was still alone. I didn't know what was happening. I was trying to understand. I was crying, trying not to cry. I picked up the phone and dialed Jones's house. I made my voice steady.
"Nope," Jones said. "Saw him yesterday. I'll be seeing him tomorrow."
I called Beau.
"Poker's tomorrow night," he told me.
I went back to his door. I banged so hard I could have knocked it down. But there was that knob. And I knew all I had to do was turn it. Instead, I picked up my phone again. Javier answered.
"You've looked everywhere?"
he asked me. "Not in his room. His door is closed." I heard the confusion in Javier's pause.
"Open it, Marin," he finally said. "Go ahead and open it."
"But what if he's in there?" My voice was so small.
"It will be slow crossing Market, but we'll be there as soon as we can."
"I'm alone," I said.
I didn't even know what I was saying. "I am calling the police. They'll probably be there before we will. You just wait. We are coming to you. We can do it together. We're leaving now."
I didn't want him to hang up, but he did. And my hands were shaking and I was facing the closed door. I turned away from it, toward the picture of my mother. I needed her. I took it off the wall. I needed to see it better. I would take it out of its glass frame. Maybe holding it in my hands would help me remember. Maybe I would feel her with me. At the coffee table, I knelt on the carpet and lifted the small metal tabs that held the frame back in place. I lifted the cardboard, and there was the yellowed back of the photograph, with a line in Gramps's handwriting. "Birdie on Ocean Beach, 1996. My vision doubled, then righted itself. The dark pressed against me. Maybe my mind was taking me in convoluted directions. Maybe Birdie was just like Sweetheart or Honey, a name that could apply to anyone. I opened his doors for the first time. Here I was, in his study. In the 15 years I'd lived there, I'd never stepped inside. One wall was lined with shelves, and on the shelves were boxes and boxes of letters. Hands shaking, I reached for one. The envelope was addressed to his P.O. box. The handwriting was his own. I unfolded the paper. "Daddy," it said, "the mountains look beautiful today. When are you going to visit me? Just for a little while? Marin has school and her own friends. You can leave her for a couple weeks." I stopped reading. I turned to the letter behind it, addressed to Claire Delaney, Colorado. No stamp, never sent. I pulled out the paper. "You know I can't do that. Not yet, but soon. Soon." I grabbed another box of letters. They were all from him to her or from her to him. They were all in his handwriting. They dated back so many years. I was trying to read, but my vision kept blurring. I heard faraway sirens. I left his study and walked into his bedroom. It smelled like cigarettes and tea. It smelled like him. His bed was made and everything was tidy. It struck me for the first time how wrong it was that I'd never seen it. How wrong to have been shut out. The door to his closet was open, all of his sweaters folded with precision. I opened a dresser drawer to the shirts I'd washed and folded for him a couple days before. I opened a smaller drawer and saw his stacks of handkerchiefs. I knew I was looking for something, but I didn't know what. The sirens were getting louder. And then I saw it. A worn velvet armchair, sitting against a door. I pushed the chair away. I turned the knob. It was a small space, somewhere between a room and a closet, and it was dark until I saw the chain dangling from the ceiling and pulled it, and light shone across all of my mother's things. They were preserved as if for a museum in clear bags with cedar blocks labeled shirts, pants and shorts, undergarments and swimwear, dresses, shoes, school papers, notes and letters, posters and souvenirs, books and magazines. Photographs of her covered the expanse of one wall. Every square inch, all these images he never showed me. She was a little girl in ruffles, a teenager in ripped jeans, a young woman in bathing suits and wetsuits, a young mother holding a baby. Holding me. The sirens stopped. There was a pounding at the door. "Police!" they yelled. In every picture, my mother was a stranger. I didn't know where Gramps was, but I knew I could never see him again. Never. There must have been a crash as the front door burst open. There must have been footsteps coming toward me. They must have been calling for anyone who was home. But nobody hurried me as I took it all in. Nobody said anything as I turned back to the clothing, took the bag marked dresses and unzipped it just to be sure, and found the deep green fabric. It unfurled like it did that day he held it up for me and didn't let me touch it. I let it drop to the floor. I turned around. Two police officers stood watching me. "Are you Marin Delaney?" I nodded. "We got a call saying you needed help." My body was heavy with longing. My heart, for the first time, full of hate. They were waiting for me to say something. "Take me away from here," I said. "We'll go over to the station," one of the cops told me. "Sure you don't want to grab a sweater?
the other one asked. I shook my head. Sorry about this, he said as I climbed into the back seat behind a metal grate. It's a quick ride.
They sat me in a chair in an office. They brought me a glass of water and then another. They left me alone and then came back.
Was he acting erratic? One of them asked.
I didn't know. He was acting like Gramps. They waited. What does it mean to act erratic?
I'm sorry, honey. Do you need a minute? We just need all the information on record. Let's just move on to the next question,
the other one said.
Do you know if your grandfather has a history of mental illness?
I laughed. You saw that room.
Any other indications?
He thought his friends were poisoning his whiskey, I said.
So there's that.
I couldn't bring myself to talk about the letters. They were there if they wanted to see them.
What makes you believe that your grandfather may be missing?
What did it mean to be missing? What did it mean to believe? All I knew was green fabric unfurling, eggs untouched, secret rooms and photographs, tea and coffee and cigarettes, a made bed, a pair of slippers, silence, the thousands of secrets he kept from me. I think he had cancer, I said. There was blood on the handkerchiefs.
Cancer,
one of them said and wrote it down. I looked at his notepad. Everything I told them was there, as though my answers really meant something, as though they would reveal the truth. Blood on handkerchiefs, I said. Will you write that too?
Sure, honey,
he said, and wrote the words down neatly.
We have a couple witnesses who saw an old man going into the water at Ocean Beach, the other said,
and I already knew it, I guess. How easily the ocean must have swept him away. I already knew it, but I felt my body go rigid, as though I were the dead one.
We have a search team out there now trying to find him, but if he's the one they saw, he's been missing for more than 8 hours.
8 hours? What time is it? The office's only window was into the hallway. Outside, it must have been daylight.
There are a couple people in the lobby waiting for you, Mr. and Mrs. Valenzuela.
I thought of Gramps being swallowed by the water. It would have been so cold. No wetsuit. Just his thin t-shirt, his bare arms, his thin skin, all his scratches and bruises. I'm really tired, I said.
I'm sure they could drive you home.
I never wanted to see him again. I never would. And yet, how would I step foot inside our house without him? The loss snuck up on me, black and cavernous. I thought of Anna and Javier, and how kindly they would look at me, and the things they might say, and how I would have to tell them what I'd discovered, and how I knew that I couldn't. My voice was thick. I think I'll take a cab.
They seem concerned about you. They've been waiting for a long time.
He must have been freezing. I thought of his tears.
We'll get a cab for you, honey, if you're sure that's what you want.
Chapter 20 I'm having trouble understanding, Mabel says. Bertie was your mother? Bertie was my mother. And all of the things that she sent him were things he already owned. And all of the letters she wrote him were things he wrote to himself. You write a letter, you get a letter. Wouldn't you have known if it was his handwriting? I never saw the envelopes, I say. I didn't even have a key to the mailbox. Okay, Mabel says. Okay. He had all of it. He had pictures of me and pictures of her. He had a fucking museum back there and he never showed me any of it. I could have known her. None of what we had was real. He wasn't real. She's forgotten to rub my hands. She's just squeezing them. But it was just grief, right? He was real. He was just, I don't know, brokenhearted?
Was he?
I thought he never lied to me. I thought I knew who he was, but he was a stranger all along. And how do I mourn a stranger? And if the person I loved wasn't even a person, then how can he be dead? This is what happens when I let myself think too much. I squeeze shut my eyes. I want darkness. Stillness. But light cuts in. Is he dead? I ask her. My voice is a whisper, the smallest version of itself. This is the thing I'm most afraid to say. The craziest thing. The thing that makes me too much like him. I don't know if he's dead. Hey, she says. Look at me. They said he drowned, but they didn't find him. They never found him. Do bodies disappear that way? Really? Look at me, Mabel says, but I can't. Look at me, she says again. I'm looking at the seams of my jeans. I'm looking at the threads in the rug. I'm looking at my shaking hands that I've snatched back from hers, and I'm sure I must be losing my mind. Like Gramps, like poor Mr. Rochester's locked-up wife, like the howling woman in the motel room next to mine. Marin, he died, Mabel says. Everyone knows that. We knew he was lost in the ocean. It was in the newspaper. We just didn't know how it happened.
But how do we really know?
We just do, she says. We just know. We just know. We just know.
But does it really happen like that?
Yes, she says.
But waves, I say. The tide,
I say. Yes, and currents that pull things under and send them far out. And rocks to get snagged on. And predators.
But are you sure?
I'm sure.
Those people who thought they saw him, they could have seen someone else.
She doesn't answer me.
It was dark, I say.
She's quiet. Marin, she says.
It was really dark. You know how dark it is out there?
Chapter 21. August. You go through life thinking there's so much you need. Your favorite jeans and sweater. The jacket with the faux fur lining to keep you warm. Your phone and your music and your favorite books. Mascara. Irish breakfast tea and cappuccinos from Trouble Coffee. You need your yearbooks. Every stiffly posed school dance photo. The notes your friends slipped into your locker. You need the camera you got for your 16th birthday. And the flowers you dried. You need your notebooks full of the things you learned and don't want to forget. You need your bedspread, white with black diamonds. You need your pillow. It fits the way you sleep. You need magazines promising self-improvement. You need your running shoes and your sandals and your boots. Your grade report from the semester you got straight A's. Your prom dress. Your shiny earrings. Your pendants on delicate chains. You need your underwear, your light-colored bras, and your black ones. The dream catcher hanging above your bed. The dozens and dozens of shells in glass jars. The cab was waiting outside the station. The airport, I said. But no sound came out. The airport, I said, and we pulled away. You think you need all of it. Until you leave with only your phone, your wallet, and a picture of your mother. Chapter 22. August. I barely remember getting there. I walked up to the ticket counter and said I had a reservation. Do you have a flight number?
I shook my head.
Spell your name for me?
I couldn't think of a single letter. I wiped my palms on my jeans. At the station, the officer said, "You sure you don't know where he is?" I was in bed when he left.
"Miss, will you spell it?"
"I'm sorry," I said. "I can't spell my name." "I'm sorry," I told them. "I made him eggs, but he didn't eat them."
"I found a reservation for Marin Delaney, SFO to LGA, but it's for the 23rd.
"I'm early," I said. "I can see that you're upset," they said.
"Let me see if I can get you on a flight today," she said. "There will be a fee."
I took out the ATM card. The heat. It swallowed me up when I arrived in New York. All my life, hot days came with cooler breezes, but even with the sun setting, the air was thick and relentless. I boarded a bus from the airport. I didn't know which direction I was going in, but it didn't really matter. I watched out the window until I saw a motel sign lighting up the dark. "Home away from home," it said. I rang the bell to get off at the next stop. The moment I stepped into the lobby, I knew it was no place to be. I should have left, but I crossed the room anyway.
"You over 18?"
the man behind the counter asked me.
"Yes,"
I said. He looked at me.
"I'm gonna need ID.
I handed him my driver's license.
"How long you staying?"
"I'll check out on the 23rd. He ran my card, nodded, handed me a key. I climbed the stairs and walked down a corridor to find room 217. I startled at the room before mine. A man stood in its window, staring. I turned the key and stepped in. Worse than stale. Worse than unclean. I tried to open the windows to get the smell out, but they only opened 3 inches, and the air outside was still thick and hot. The curtains were stiff, coated in something. The carpet was splotchy and worn, the comforter torn. I put my photograph in its folder down on the chair along with my wallet and my phone. Next door to me, a woman started howling and didn't stop. Below me, someone blasted telenovelas. I heard something break. It's possible that some of the rooms were occupied by regular people, down on their luck. But my wing was full of the broken, and I was at home among them. By then it was late, and I hadn't eaten anything. I was amazed that I could be hungry, but my stomach was churning and growling, so I crossed the street to the diner. I sat myself, like the sign told me to. I ordered a grilled cheese and French fries and a chocolate shake. I feared nothing would fill me up. It was pitch black when I headed back across the street. I asked the motel clerk for a toothbrush. She told me there was a drugstore across the street, but then handed me a travel kit that someone had left behind, still enclosed in plastic, with a tiny toothbrush and a tiny tube of paste. I walked past my neighbor, still staring out the window. As I splashed water on my face, I thought I heard Gramps singing. But when I turned the faucet off, there was nothing. I went back outside. I knocked on the door next to mine. The man opened it. He had sunken cheeks and bloodshot eyes. He was the kind of person I'd cross the street to steer clear of. "I need to ask you something," I said. "If you see an old man outside my room, will you knock on the wall to let me know?"
"Sure,"
he said. And then I fell asleep, knowing he was watching. 3 nights later, I heard a tap above my head. Would he be bloodstained? Would he be ghostly? Outside, it was quiet. There was no one. My neighbor's vacant eyes peered through the screen. I knew that he hadn't moved for a long time. It wasn't he who had knocked. Maybe a rodent burrowing through walls. Maybe my mind playing tricks. Maybe someone upstairs. Maybe him haunting me.
He sang each time I turned on the faucet, so I stopped using the water. There were only 6 days left before I could move into the dorms. At the drugstore, I bought a gallon of water for drinking and toothbrushing. I bought a bottle of hand sanitizer. I bought a pack of white t-shirts and a pack of white underwear. I bought baby powder for the oil in my hair. I ordered split pea soup, scrambled eggs, coffee. I used the ATM card. I tipped 18%. I said thank you. They said see you tonight. See you in the morning. The cherry pie is special today. I said thank you. I said see you. I looked both ways. I crossed the street. I turned on the television. Judge Judy. Laugh tracks. Always. Dove. Swiffer. I pulled back the blankets, ignored the stains. I burrowed under like a rodent in a wall. I kept trying to find the right position. I made myself very still. I made my eyes shut. You're okay, I told myself. Shh, I said. Chapter 23 Come with me, Mabel says. Our talk is over. We're on the floor across from each other, each of us leaning against a bed. I should feel a weight lifted now that I've told her everything. But I don't. Not yet. Maybe in the morning some new feeling will settle. I promise, this is the last time I'll ask. Just come home for a few days. If it weren't for the lies he told me. If Birdie had been an elderly woman with beautiful penmanship. If his coats were all that hung in the closet, and he'd known his lungs were black, and he drank his whiskey without suspicion. If I could stop dreaming up a deathbed scene where his hospital blankets are crisp over his stomach and his hands are holding mine, where he says something like, "See you on the other side, sailor," or, "I love you, sweetheart," and a nurse touches my shoulder and tells me it's over, even though I can already see it by the peaceful stillness of him. "Take your time," she says, so we just stay there, he and I, until the darkness falls, and I am strong enough to leave the room without him. "How am I supposed to leave you here?" Mabel asks. "I'm sorry. I will go with you, someday, but I can't do it tomorrow." She picks at the frayed edges of the rug. "Mabel." She won't look at me. Everything is quiet. I'd suggest going somewhere, just out for a walk even, but we're both confounded by the cold. The moon is framed perfectly in the window, a crescent of white against black, and I can see by its clearness that it isn't snowing anymore. "I shouldn't have only called and texted. I should have flown to you." "It's okay." "He seemed sick for so long, kind of frail or something." "I know." Her eyes tear over, and she looks out the window. I wonder if she sees what I do, if she feels the same stillness. "Mabel," I want to say, "we don't have much time left." "Mabel, there is me, and there is you, and the snow has finished falling. Let's just sit here." Sometime later, we stand side by side at the sinks in the bathroom. We look tired and something else, too. It takes me a minute to identify it. And then I know. We look young. Mabel smears toothpaste onto her toothbrush. She hands me the tube. She doesn't say, "Here you go." I don't say, "Thank you." I brush in the circular way you're supposed to. Mabel brushes back and forth. Hard. I watch my reflection and concentrate on giving each tooth enough time. Standing like this in Mabel's bathroom back home, we would never have been silent. There were always millions of things to talk about, each topic pressing in so that our conversations rarely began and ended, but rather began and were interrupted and continued, strands of thoughts that got pushed aside and picked up later. If our past selves got a glimpse of us now, what would they make of us? Our bodies are the same, but there's a heaviness in Mabel's shoulders, a weariness in the way my hip leans against the counter, a puffiness around her eyes, a darkness under mine. But more than those things, there's the separateness of us. I didn't return Mabel's 900 texts because I knew we'd end up like this no matter what. What happened had broken us, even if it wasn't about us at all, because I know that for all her care and understanding, when this visit is over and she's back in L.A. with Jacob and her new friends, sitting in her lecture halls or riding the Ferris wheel in Santa Monica or eating dinner by herself in front of an open textbook, she'll be the same as she's always been, fearless and funny and whole. She'll still be herself, and I'll be learning who I am now. She spits into the sink. I spit into the sink. We rinse our brushes, tap-tap, in close succession. Both faucets run as we splash our faces. I don't know what she's thinking about. I can't even guess. We walk back down the hallway, shut off the lights, and climb into opposite twin beds. My eyes are open in the dark. "Good night," I say. She's quiet. "I hope you don't think," she says, "that because of Jacob..." She looks at me for an indication that I understand. She gives up. "It's not that I met him and forgot about you. I was trying to move on. You didn't give me other options. The night before I was supposed to go out with him, I tried sending you another text. 'Remember Nebraska?' That's what I wrote. I stayed up late hoping you'd answer me. I slept with the phone by my pillow. All it would have taken was one word from you, and I wouldn't have gone. I would have waited longer. But you shut me out," she says. "I'm not trying to make you feel guilty. I understand now, really. But I just need you to know how it happened. I'm happy now, with him. But I wouldn't be with him if you'd have answered me." The pain when she says this, it's not her fault. Deep in my chest is still an aching hollowness, vacancy, fear. I can't imagine opening myself up to the rush of kissing her. Can't imagine her hands under my clothes. "I'm sorry," I say. "I know I'm the one who disappeared." I can still see the moon out the window. I can still feel the stillness of the night. I can hear Mabel saying that Gramps is dead, gone, sounding so certain, and I try to feel that certainty too. I try not to think of her heartbreak, how I caused it, but I can't keep it out, and it rushes over me. "I'm sorry," I say again. "I know," Mabel says. "I understand." "Thank you for coming," I say. The hours stretch on, and I fall in and out of sleep, and at some point she slips out of bed and out of the room. She stays away for a long time, and I try to stay awake until she comes back, but I just wait and wait and wait. When I wake up again at the first light of the morning, she's back in Hannah's bed, sleeping with her arm covering her eyes, as if she could stave off the day. Chapter 24. When I open my eyes again, she isn't here. I'm seized with panic that I've missed her altogether, that she's already gone and I haven't gotten to say goodbye. But here is her duffel open in the middle of my floor. The thought of her slinging it over her shoulder and walking out is enough to make me double over. I have to fill the minutes between now and then with as much as I can. I climb out of bed and take out the gifts I bought. I wish I had wrapping paper, or at least some ribbon, but the tissue paper will have to do. I put on a bra and change into jeans and a t-shirt. I brush my hair. For some reason, I don't want to be in my pajamas when I walk her down the stairs.
"Hey," she says from the doorway.
"Good morning," I say, trying not to cry. "I'll be right back." I rush through peeing and brushing my teeth so that I can be back there with her. I catch her before she zips up her suitcase. "I was thinking we could wrap this in your clothes," I say, and hand her the vase I bought for her parents. She takes it from me and nestles it into her things. She goes to reach for the zipper, but I stop her. "Close your eyes and hold out your hands," I say.
"Shouldn't I wait?" she asks.
Lots of people exchange gifts on Christmas Eve.
"But the thing I got you is..."
"I know. It doesn't matter. I want to see you open it." She nods. "Close your eyes," I say again. She closes them. I look at her. I wish her everything good. A friendly cab driver in short lines through security. A flight with no turbulence and an empty seat next to her. A beautiful Christmas. I wish her more happiness than can fit in a person. I wish her the kind of happiness that spills over. I place the bell into her open palms. She opens her eyes and unwraps it.
"You noticed," she says.
"Ring it." She does, and the tone lingers, and we wait quietly until it's over.
"Thank you," she says. "It's so pretty."
She slings her bag over her shoulder, and it hurts just as much as I expected it to. I follow her into the elevator. When we get to the door, the cab is waiting in a sea of white.
"You're sure, right?" she asks.
"Yeah," I say. She looks out the window. She bites a nail.
"You're sure you're sure?"
I nod. She takes a deep breath, manages a smile.
"Okay. Well, I'll see you soon."
She steps toward me and hugs me tight. I close my eyes. There will come a time soon, any second, when she'll pull away and this will be over. In my mind, we keep ending. Ending. I try to stay here now. For as long as we can. I don't care that her sweater is scratchy. I don't care that the cab driver is waiting. I feel her rib cage expand and retract. We stay and stay. Until she lets me go.
"See you soon,"
I say, but the words come out thick with despair. I'm making the wrong choice. The glass door opens. Cold rushes in. She steps outside and shuts the door behind her. When I lived with Jones and Agnes, it was their daughter Samantha who made me breakfast. Wheat bread and applesauce every morning. We ate matching meals, perched on the stools in their kitchen. She'd look over my homework if I had questions, but I remember not wanting to ask for much help. She'd always scrunch up her forehead and say how it had been a long time since she learned this stuff. She'd figure it out eventually and talk me through it, but it was more fun to ask about her magazines, because she delighted in talking about them. I learned what DUIs were because Paris Hilton and Nicole Richie both got them. The news of Tom Cruise and Katie Holmes's wedding was everywhere. I learned what to wait for with each new issue's release. I rarely saw Jones and Agnes until after school, because they slept late and entrusted Samantha with my morning care. She was always nice to me after that. She always did my nails for free. I don't have her number anymore. It's been a long time since she's lived with her parents. I wish I had it now. I call the salon, just in case she's there early doing work before it opens, but the phone rings and rings, and then goes to voicemail. I listen to her voice slowly stating the hours and location. I pace the room for a while, waiting for it to be 10 in San Francisco. As soon as it's 1 here, I press call.
"It's you,"
Jones says when I say hello.
Yeah, I say. It's me.
Where are you?
School.
He's quiet.
I see,
he says.
You spending the holiday with some fellow troublemakers?
He's probably running inventory of who I could be with, envisioning a few of us here, a scrappy team of orphans and outcasts.
Something like that, I say. I should have prepared something to say to him. The truth is, I only called so that I could remind him, and myself maybe, that I'm still a part of the world. It feels like now or never with him, and I'm not sure if I want to lose what's left of the life Gramps and I shared. I used to be sure, but now I'm not. I'm about to ask how Agnes is, but he speaks before I get the words out.
I have everything, he says, just so you know. Whether you want it or not, everything is here in the garage, waiting for you. Not the beds or the refrigerator or nothing like that, but the real stuff. The owner arranged an estate sale after the place was vacant 30 days, but the guys and I, we bought it all.
I close my eyes. Brass candlesticks. The blue and gold blanket. My grandmother's china with the tiny red flowers.
We all feel real bad about it, he says. Feel like we should have done something. For you.
What about the letters? Quiet. He clears his throat.
They're here. The landlord gave us the, more personal stuff.
Can you get rid of them?
I can do that.
Keep the photographs, though, okay?
Mm-hmm,
he says. I think of all of those pictures that Gramps kept for himself. My jaw clenches with the wrongness of it. He should have sat next to me and shown me. He should have said, "Now I think this was the time that..." Or, "Oh yes, I remember this day." He should have told me all the ways in which I reminded him of her. He should have helped me remember her. He never should have let me forget. Jones is still quiet. I hear his throat clearing.
Your Gramps. He was in a hospital a long time ago, when you stayed with us. Not sure if you remember. It almost killed him, so we didn't want to send him back there. Wish I could say that was the right decision. Wish I could say I didn't realize it got so bad again. Wish I could say that.
I breathe in and out. It requires effort. I thought he was sick.
Well, he was. Just in more ways than you thought.
He clears his throat again. I wait.
Sometimes it's difficult,
he says,
to know the right thing to do.
I nod, even though he can't see me. There's no arguing with a statement like that, even if a different future is unfurling in my head, one where I knew what Gramps' prescriptions were for, and I watched to make sure he took them, and he took me along to his appointments, and his doctors told me what to watch for. I need to find something kind to say, something instead of these thoughts of how Gramps failed me, how Jones failed us. He knows it already. I can hear it in his voice. Merry Christmas Eve, Jones, I finally say, wanting the conversation to end.
You get religious all of a sudden? If your Gramps had a grave, he'd be turning in it.
It's a rough joke, the kind they used to make in my kitchen. It's just something to say, I tell him. Out the window, the snow is starting again. Not storm-like, just scattered flakes drifting. Give Agnes and Samantha my love, Jones, and tell the fellas I say hello. After I hang up, I cut open Hannah's envelope and something flutters out. It unfolds in its descent, a paper chain of snowflakes, each one white and crisp. There is no message inside. It's exactly what it appears to be.
Chapter 25. September. I showed up on the day of freshman orientation, accompanied by no one. A duffel over my shoulder, stuffed with my clothes, some crackers, and the picture of Birdie. I saw Hannah's alarm when I appeared in our doorway. Then I saw her catch herself and smile. She held out her hand, but her shock had taken me by the shoulders and shaken. I was here, at a school, surrounded by girls my own age. No one screamed at the television. No one stood for hours at their windows. No one avoided turning the tap, for fear of ghosts. I told myself, pull it together. I was a normal girl. I was not the kind to cause alarm. I was the kind who showered daily and wore clean clothes and answered the phone when it rang. When danger approached, I crossed the street. When mornings came, I ate breakfast. This person who stood in the doorway wasn't me. I shook Hannah's hand. I made my face smile. I must look like a disaster, I said. I've had a rough couple weeks. I'm going to set my stuff down and find the showers. Did I see relief pass over her? I hoped so. I went to unzip my duffel, but thought of all the dirty clothes stuffed inside, of the smell they'd emit, and thought better. I'm going to find the laundry, too, I said.
Second floor, Hannah told me, and the bathrooms are right around the corner. We did the family tour this morning.
I smiled again. Thanks, I said. Most of the showers were in a row, locker room style, but I found one full bathroom with a door that locked. I pulled off my shirt and my pants, let them drop to the floor. This place was so much cleaner than where I'd been. I stepped out of my underwear, unclasped my bra. The girl in the mirror was feral. Puffy face, wild eyes, greasy hair. No wonder Hannah was shocked. I was shocked, too. But I didn't have soap or shampoo. It was enough to make me cry. Water could only do so much. I wanted a room full of steam and the smell of lavender or peach. There was liquid soap on the wall by the sink. I pumped as much as one hand could hold and then opened the shower door with the other. As if by magic, sitting on a shelf were containers of hotel shampoo, conditioner, and soap. I turned the tap and washed the yellow chemical soap down the drain. As the water warmed, I examined the little hotel bottles. Eucalyptus. I stepped under the water and closed myself into the square, mint-green-tiled space. Its smallness was comforting. All I heard was water falling, water echoing. Eucalyptus filled the room. I shampooed and rinsed until the bottle was empty. I washed my face and my body with the soap. I let the conditioner stay in for a very long time. In California, we were always worried about droughts, always conserving water. But I was far away.
I'm far away,
I whispered. I stayed longer. The hot water lasted forever. I knew I could wash away the dirt and the grease, but the wildness in my eyes was more difficult. And that was the worst part. I told myself to just breathe. I breathed in. I breathed out. Over and over. Until I wasn't aware I was in the shower, in the dorms, in New York. Until I wasn't aware of anything. Putting dirty clothes back on was a sacrilege. I chose the least worn of them and stuffed the rest into the washer with detergent from the vending machine. Then I went to find the student store, desperate for something else to wear in the meantime. The store was chaos. Parents and their kids swarmed through the aisles, admiring knickknacks, complaining over the cost of textbooks. The incoming freshmen whined and fretted. Everything was the most important thing ever. I was invisible, moving silently among them toward the clothing section, the only solitary person there. What I found filled me with awe. I had no idea such school spirit could exist. There were t-shirts and polo shirts and sweatshirts and sweatpants and shorts. panties and boxers and bras, pajamas and tank tops and socks and flip-flops, even a dress, all of them emblazoned with the school colors and mascot, all of them so clean. I bought an armful, over $300 worth of clothes. As I swiped the ATM card, I tamped down the knowledge that my funds would run out, not soon, but not too long from then either. Unless I found a way to start putting some money back in the account, I would be broke in a year. I asked to use the dressing room on my way out and pulled on the clean bra and underwear. The panties had a picture of the mascot across the butt. They were fun, even if only I would ever see them. The bra was sportier than any I'd ever had, but it was cute anyway. The day was hot, so I chose the terry cloth shorts, grateful that my blondness allowed me to show my legs, even when I hadn't shaved them for a while. Last came a t-shirt, the creases still there from how it was folded. I looked at myself in the full-length mirror. My hair was clean and straight, still a little damp. My clothes fit me fine. I smelled like a spa. I looked like any other girl. I stopped by the laundry room on the way back, but instead of putting my clothes in the dryer, I threw them into the trash. Hannah was in her room when I showed up again, and this time her parents were there too. Her mom was putting sheets on her bed. Her stepdad was hanging a framed poster from a Broadway production of Rent. "Hi," I said from the doorway. How many times do you get the chance to do something over again? To do it over right. You only get to make one first impression, unless the person you meet possesses a rare and specific kind of generosity. Not the kind that gives you the benefit of the doubt. Not the kind that says, "Once I get to know her better, she'll probably be fine." But the kind that says, "No. Unacceptable." The kind that says, "You can do better. Now show me." "You must be Marin," our mom said. "We've been dying to meet you."
"Now tell us," said her stepdad. "Is it Marin like Mariner, or Marin like the county?"
"The county," I said. "It's so nice to meet you." I shook their hands. Hannah said, "Nice to meet you, Marin." We smiled at each other, as though the morning had never happened. "I hope you don't mind that I claimed this side."
"None at all."
"Did your family leave already?" Hannah's mom asked. "Actually, they couldn't make it. I'm getting started with this independence thing a little early." Hannah's stepdad said,
"Well, put us to work. We'd love to help."
"Do you have sheets?" her mom asked, folding Hannah's bedspread over. I shook my head no. The bare mattress glared at me. I wondered how many other things I hadn't planned for.
"My mom packed me way too many sets," Hannah said.
"Well, good thing," her mom said. Soon Hannah's side of the room looked like she'd already lived there for months, and mine was bare except for some red-striped sheets, a soft pillow, and a cream-colored blanket. "Thanks so much," I told her parents as they left. I tried to sound casually grateful and not how I really felt, as though they had saved my life. And Hannah kept saving me. She saved me with never asking questions, with instead reading to me about bees and botany and evolution. She saved me with clothes she loaned me and never took back. She saved me with seats next to her in the dining hall, with quick evasions when people asked me questions I couldn't answer, with chapters read aloud and forced trips off campus and rides to the grocery store, and a pair of winter boots. Chapter 26. I take a couple pushpins out of the jar on Hannah's desk and approach my empty bulletin board. I pin the snowflake chain along the top of it, and then text Hannah a picture. She texts back right away, two high fives with a heart between them. It feels so good. I want to do more. I take my new pot out of its bag and set it on my desk. My peperomia is thriving,
each leaf full and luminous. Carefully, I ease its roots out of the plastic cup it came in. I pour the leftover dirt into Claudia's pot, and then place the roots in the middle, pressing the soil around it. I pour in some leftover water from a cup Mabel was using. I'll need to get more soil when I can, but it's enough for now. I cross the room and turn to look at my desk. Two yellow bowls, a pink pot with a green leafy plant, a strand of paper snowflakes. It's pretty, but it needs something more. I drag my desk chair over to my closet and stand on it so that I can reach the top shelf. I find the only thing up there, the photograph of my mother at 22 years old, standing in the sun. I borrow four of Hannah's silver pushpins and choose the right spot on my bulletin board, just to the right of the snowflakes, and push the pins in against the corners of the photograph so that they hold it up without making any holes. It's a big photograph, 8x10 probably, and it transforms the corner. I'm not saying that it doesn't scare me to bring it into the light. My mother on Ocean Beach, her sun-faded peach surfboard leaning under her arm, her black wetsuit and wet hair, her squinting eyes and her huge smile. It scares me, yes, but it also feels right. I stare at her. I try and I try and I try to remember. A couple hours later, I take a long shower. I let the water run over me. When I go back, whenever that will be, I'll need to find something of Gramps's to scatter or bury. I couldn't laugh at Jones's joke. Instead, it's echoing the way true things always do when I've been trying to deny them. If your Gramps had a grave. If your Gramps had a grave. Enough time has passed by now that I know Mabel is right. But another version of the story springs up sometimes, one of him with pockets full of a few thousand dollars, gambling winnings he kept for himself on his way to the Rocky Mountains. I need to give him a grave in order to contain him. I need to bury something to anchor his ghost. One of these days, in some not-so-far future, I'll take a trip into Jones's garage, and I'll search through our old things, and I'll assemble a box of objects instead of ashes, and I'll find him a place to rest. I rinse the conditioner out of my hair. I turn off the water and breathe in the steam. He wore a gold chain around his neck on special occasions. I wonder if Jones bought it back for me. I dry off and wrap myself in a towel. When I get back to my room, I look at my phone. It's only 2 o'clock. I take a cue from the list I made on my first night here alone and make soup. I chop vegetables and boil pasta. Pour a carton of chicken stock into a pot. Once I've combined all the ingredients and it's time to wait while they cook, I turn to the second essay in the Solitude book, but my mind is too full of different versions of the last summer's story. There's one where I fail him, where I stop coming home so he stops making dinner, and I'm not around to see how much he needs me. And then there's one where he fails me, where I feel it, that he doesn't want me there, that I'm in the way. So I stay away for him and for me, so that I never face his rejection, so that I get to pretend I'm the most important thing to him, the way he is to me. Because if we have any sense of self-preservation, we do the best with what we're given. I was given cakes and cookies and rides to school. I was given songs and dinners at a table with brass candlesticks. I was given a man with a sensitive heart and a devious sense of humor and enough skill at cards to win me a year of private college, tuition, and room and board. And I took all of those good things and told myself they made us special. Told myself they meant we were a family, the way Mabel and Anna and Javier were. Told myself that we weren't missing anything. We were masters of collusion, Gramps and I. In that, at least, we were together. When yearbooks came out, I didn't flip straight to the back like everyone else to find the seniors' pages. Instead, I started at the front.